You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, in-person classes, and customized corporate workshops and performances. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. You can go online and find out all the information you need at secondcity.com. Today's guest on the pod is Savala Nolan. She is a writer, speaker, and lawyer. She is the executive director of the Felton E. Henderson Center for Social Justice at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. She's got a new book. It's called Don't Let It Get You Down, Essays on Race, Gender, and the Body. Enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Savala Nolan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kelly. It's really a pleasure to be here.
When I finished your new book over the weekend, I had this thought. You're navigating really painful and unjust topics, but you do so with such beautiful writing. And it reminded me of how, when I was going through very deep grief, one of my avenues of respite was poetry. And so I sensed this theme, and it's come up a lot with my guests on this podcast, that our ability to hold how ugly and beautiful the world can be in the same moment is a kind of superpower. Does that make any sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't go so far as to say I have the superpower.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I do either.
But I certainly aspire to it. Before I have a comment, you know, regarding the superpower, but I also just want to say how much I love poetry and what a respite it has been for me in moments of grief. And also at this point in time, it feels like the language of poetry is the opposite of an algorithm. Yes. There's a way that it's like extremely refreshing. And I hate to use the word cleansing because I sound so West Coast, which I am. But, you know, I don't know if the Chicago audience will...
We got a national audience. It's fine. And you
okay, good. So not everyone will recoil by the use of, from the use of that word, but there's something very cleansing about it. It's like the opposite of being fed algorithmic information. So I too relate to poetry. And part of the reason that I relate to poetry and love it so much is because of what you've said about this ability to hold, you know, the bad and the good, the dark and the light, however you want to think about it. Poetry is complex enough to do that. And as a writer, you know, I hope that my writing is complex enough to do that. And, you know, I think if we're unwilling to go into the shadow side of ourselves or our lives, you know, we're missing like a real solid chunk of what is there to be learned or seen or savored or excavated. I'm someone who's pretty introspective and interested in growth. You know, I suppose if I weren't so inclined, I might not be so interested in the shadow side of things. You know, but you know, night and day, like winter, summer, it's sort of a natural law, right? Yeah, that we contend with duality. And we ignore that, I think, at our own peril, ultimately.
Agreed. All right. So this book is about you, and Walt Whitman said, you know, I contain multitudes. You contain many multitudes, right?
I do.
talk to us about who you are.
Well, I'm a little bit of everything. There's a way in which I think that makes me kind of a dual citizen of a lot of the poles in our culture. And I'll just flesh that out a little bit. You know, I am Black and white. I identify as a mixed Black person. But of course, in terms of my heritage, I am Black and I am white. Related to that, I'm descended from slaveholders on my mom's side and enslaved people on my dad's side. And you can guess, you know, which is the white and which is the Black side there. I happen to be put in a private school in first grade, like a very posh Tony private school, and went to private schools most of my life. And so I've moved in some very elite, wealthy spaces, but I wasn't born into wealth. You know, there's real abject generational poverty in parts of my family, on the Black and brown side of my family, maybe unsurprisingly. And so I guess you could say I'm comfortable in these very ritzy spaces, but I've also been at home, for better and worse, in the very opposite of that. I'm a woman, and I mentioned that because I'm also someone who has been fat and thin basically throughout my entire life, since I was, I don't know, maybe 4 years old is when I was put on my first diet. And, you know, you learn something about womanhood and kind of what women are meant to be like in our culture, I think, when you have the right body, quote unquote, and the wrong body, quote unquote. So yes, I have this resume of polarities that informs how I look at the world and how I write about the world, and in particular, how I think about what it means to have a body and, you know, what we learn when we sort of put our attention on our bodies and how our bodies move through the world.
And the book is a collection of these incredibly rich essays, and I do want to get to them in a moment. But first, another thought sort of struck me in the introduction to your book, because you write, quote, I wrote this book to illuminate these dominant and subordinated spaces and the space that both separates and binds them. I wrote to articulate a space between. Beautiful. It reminded me of something. And I went and looked up my notes. I'd interviewed George Lipsitz, who is a professor of Black Studies and Sociology at the University of California. And he wrote a book called Insubordinate Spaces, Improvisation and Accompaniment for Social Justice. And so I'm very interested in improvisation, come out of this Viola Spolin tradition. She was a social worker, so that's a roots. But there's also a tradition of improvisation by Augusta Boal, which was all social justice. And he wrote in the book, quote, everyone has a part of the truth. That's people's weaknesses, that people's weaknesses come from many of the same sources as their strengths, and that the truth and the lie, or the right thing and the wrong thing, are often not mutually incommensurable opposites, but instead different poles of a dialogically and dialectically connected unity. That's kind of, isn't it? It's like, that's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, I love it. I mean, that right there, I guess maybe I didn't need to write my book.
No, you need to write your book. Your book is different.
Kind of just pointed people to that idea, but it's so true. There's a quote by Walt Whitman that kind of reminds me of that, where he writes that all truths wait in all things. Mm. And I love that because I think it's true, you know, on some kind of ineffable, almost pre-verbal way. But that idea of all truths, that is the shadow and the light, you know, that truth is full of duality. And the idea that all the things that are true can exist in every single one of us really speaks to me, probably the way that quote speaks to you.
Yeah. So the first essay is on dating white guys while me. I was very curious about this. My first wife was a Nigerian black woman. And I'm like, am I going to find something inside this? And it was very different experiences. And I think maybe too, being African born and, you know, live and went to boarding school in England. And like, so very different experience. There's a few things in here that were really interesting. One, you write in the book, quote, My feet have always struck me as my tell of otherness, even more than my nose or hair or weight. Now that, I think that surprises people. I mean, because you wear shoes a lot, right? But yeah. But I guess when you take them off, that's the fear, right?
Well, I mean, so as I say in the book, I wear a size women's size 12 and sometimes a women's 13, mm-hmm. Which is a post-pregnancy thing. You know, my feet got a little bigger after I had my daughter, mm-hmm. much to my chagrin. And, you know, when you have big feet, like, yes, they're certainly more visible without shoes, but you can't really hide them in shoes either. So it's something that has, you know, I guess haunted me. I mean, I'm much less self-conscious about it now than I used to be. But for whatever reason, my feet just became this part of my body, you know, on which all of these lies that I had sort of absorbed about myself and all of these ways in which I felt problematically other, you know, in which mm-hmm. I felt sort of vulgar instead of dainty and cute, you know, the way a girl is quote supposed to be. They all just landed on my feet, you know. I guess maybe my feet were extra big when I was little, you know, and I had to grow into them. I just, even since I was a kid, I was very self-conscious about them. And like, sure, I think it's somewhat of a personal quirk to me that my feet happen to be that part of my body. But I suspect that it's fairly universal for us to have some place on our body that we tend to hide or are self-conscious about revealing because we're afraid that, you know, having it in the sunlight will reveal something about us,
right?
That we don't like or that we're nervous about, you know? So hopefully there's some universality, even though yes, for feet are probably not the thing for most people.
And you too talk about, You write, quote, chasing these dudes was like simultaneously experiencing my demise and ordering it. Wow. That sucks.
Yes, it did suck. It's funny to go back and read that essay in particular, which I wrote. Let's see, it was one of the essays that was actually in my book proposal. So, of course, once I began actually working on the book in earnest, my editor had notes about that piece. And so it's different than it looked in the book proposal. But all of which is to say, I have been with this piece and it's been with me for a long time, but still every time I read it, that feeling feels vivid to me of, I mean, talk about duality, right? There was a way in which what I hoped was by winning the approval of a certain type of white guy, I would be sort of airlifted out of my otherness. You know, I would be saved from feeling so incredibly different and unworthy. And so at the time that I was doing this pursuit of these men, you know, which I'm not engaged in anymore, but I was, you know, until fairly recently, it was indeed like, I knew that gaining their approval would, you know, essentially the function of their approval to me was to obliterate the parts of myself that I didn't like, right? Yeah. So to gain their approval was actually this like very bizarre kind of painful self-erasure, you know, that I was mm-hmm. experiencing and pursuing. I mean, it was a rough experience and I had to do it over and over and over again until, you know, I was ready to stop, as we often have to do with these rough patterns in our lives.
There, we do a lot of work with the behavioral science community. And so I get exposed to a lot of academic literature. And there is a theory by William Swan called self-verification theory that I've talked about before on the pod. It's fascinating to me because I've always felt like people want to be seen as their best selves or their smartest self or that sort of thing. Swan says, no, we want to be seen as we see ourselves, which explains a lot in terms of, right?
Yes. Yeah, it really does. I mean, it explains why it's almost comforting to have your worst fears about yourself confirmed.
Yes.
Right.
Right. It scratches that itch, but it's
And then if we can work on ourselves, you know, and learn to love ourselves in certain kinds of ways, you know, we can make better choices in terms of our partners.
I mean, that's fascinating. I have not ever heard of that or that theory, but boy, does it ring true. Oh,
I was in a room with a bunch of us when my friend Heather Caruso is the associate dean of diversity and inclusion at UCLA. She said it to us, and we all stopped. We're like, oh God, this explains so much of my bad choices.
Exactly. It explains like your, well, for me, I shouldn't say your, I don't know anything about your dating life, Kelly, but it explains
why. Yeah, I'm better now. It's fine.
You know, age, I don't know, 15 to 30 or something.
Yeah, right.
Seeking out mirrors and other people that would reflect back to me the most, you know, I guess, darkest, most wounded version of myself, because somehow it felt like a confirmation in a way that is so sad, but of course, incredibly human.
Right. And we thank God we have the opportunity to grow and, you know, be different kinds of selves, which we are. We're not static.
Right.
The Don't Let It Get You Down essay was reminiscent of something for me. I had an assistant a long time ago, and we were having problems. Like, she wasn't showing up on time and other stuff. And she basically was like, well, I have depression. And I hadn't had any experience with depression. And she gave me a book by William Styron. And I found a quote, I looked it up, and it says, quote, "It is hopelessness even more than pain that crushes the soul." And I'm like, oh, and then you talk in this essay about the experience of being a Black woman in America. And this line really struck me, which is, quote, "There is never a true reprieve. There is always a robbery underway." I don't think it is very hard sitting in a place of white male privilege that I sit in. I think if you had told me that academically, I don't think I'd understand it. When you told it me poetically, I got it. And it's, you know, what does one say?
Thank you, Kelly. That is the highest praise for me as a writer. You know, is it something that I said illuminated a space that was in the dark for someone, or made them feel something that they might not have otherwise felt? That's always my goal.
Yeah.
When I'm writing. And, you know, with this book, I think for some people, like, that sense of there always being a robbery underway and there never being a reprieve from the violation or the fear of violation or having to do cleanup after the violation, you know, will feel very familiar, right? Because maybe they have identities like I do where that feels true. And for other people, it will have more of a revelatory ring to it. And I welcome both. I welcome both. I think, you know, pain and hopelessness are interesting ideas to kind of rub up against each other, you know, because they are different. There is a tremendous amount of pain in being Black in America. Maybe in many parts of the world, but I can only speak to what I know. There's also a tremendous joy and satisfaction. I mean, if you read the whole book, you know, like, I talk about the pain of Blackness, but I also am very, very clear that for me, Blackness is a gift and it's something I would never trade. And the richness of it is like unparalleled for me in my life. I don't know. I think that's true for 99.9% of Black people I know and meet. But the pain is unabating in a certain way.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I get asked a lot whether I am hopeful or hopeless about race relations in this country. You know, I've been asked it in relation to the book, and I've been asked it just in relation to my day job as an attorney. And I go back and forth on the answer, but, you know, I never feel hopeless about Black people. I do sometimes feel hopeless about whether people who are white can extricate themselves from the system of whiteness.
Right.
Enough to kind of crumble the hierarchy that we live under. But I never feel hopeless about Black people.
Yeah. I think for white people, you know, when if you're a fish, you don't see the water. And so, you know, certainly I'm 55 years old, always been a liberal, you know, married a Black woman, like it, but it didn't matter. They're like the learning that, especially over the last couple of years, it, you know, taking, not centering myself or whiteness at the center of every single story. And it, it like, and still to this, like, that's an everyday thing because we're still living in the privilege and the systems. And I'm not a good systems thinker anyway. So that was also just like, oh God, this is so, when I learned about redlining and then going deep on that in terms of, oh, it's food deserts and then there's no trees. And so the air is worse. I mean, it's fucked up if you give yourself any time. And then the other story in this essay, my friend Tanya, who's a Second City instructor, actress, the most long time African-American woman, was told 4 times that she didn't have COVID when she had COVID.
Oh God.
And you had that experience when you got in a accident in your car, right? And I mean, it's like, and then in the birth of your child, right? I mean, these were not good experiences. And there's so much data on this. I actually looked this up. John Hopkins Journal, they had an astonishing example from 2 Baltimore neighborhoods. The difference in average life expectancy between Uptown Druid Heights, which is a mostly impoverished Black neighborhood, and Roland Park, a mostly wealthy white neighborhood, is 20 years.
It's shocking, but it's not surprising.
Shocking, not surprising.
Yeah, no, shocking, yeah. Not surprising. I mean, I saw a map. I wish I could say where I saw it so that people could authenticate it for themselves, but it was a very reputable source. I want to say it might have been like the PBS NewsHour that mapped COVID death and severe COVID cases in the South and compared them to the counties in which chattel slavery was most prevalent. And there was, I mean, they basically were identical. Right. So shocking, not surprising. And, you know, the other reason it's not surprising to me, you know, these kind of inequities and inequalities is that we are taught and encouraged, all of us, Black, white, and everybody else, to think of the racial harms in this culture as being in the past. You know, we're taught to think of chattel slavery as being the racial harm and taught to think that it's the distant past, you know, centuries and centuries ago. And there's a way in which, like, yes, it was a long time ago. And there's another way in which it really wasn't. You know, in the book, I talk about my godfather, who is in his 80s. And when he was born in the 1930s, right? So this is living memory for him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The last known person to be kidnapped in Africa and transported across the Middle Passage through the black market of chattel slavery and then sold into slavery in Alabama, as it happened to be, this person was still alive. She was still alive in the 1930s, as were something like 100,000 formerly enslaved people. So we're not talking about something that, like,
no,
is distant, you know, distant, the distant past. Who is it? I feel like you're going to know this, Kelly, and I don't know why I'm drawing a blank. Oh, it must have been Faulkner, who said, the past isn't dead. It isn't even past, yeah, I believe, past. Is the quote.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, there's that duality of, like, the past is also kind of the present, right? We talk about them as if there is a thick, high, impenetrable wall between them. But actually, if there's a wall at all, it's quite porous.
Yeah.
And we ourselves carry things from both sides of that wall, you know, with us in our bodies and in our brains and in our interactions with other people.
Well, there's a reason literature and plays have been talking about ghosts for so long.
Yes.
You know, and that, you know, that's why Shakespeare is so brilliant. It's like, oh my God, I'm working on a project right now where I commissioned two writers to develop basically an update of The Great Gatsby because it's went into public domain.
Yeah.
We read the book and we're like, we've learned nothing. This is a book about how we have learned nothing. That should be the show. And it's like Great Gatsby 2. It's so dumb and so smart at the same time, the idea. And I'm like, let's do it and let's sort of explore. And actually very a black and white team, and we want to explore those sort of issues because it feels right for that.
Yes.
I think the underlying idea, not said out loud, is that Gatsby was Jewish. Not said, but I think that was what was going on. So
fascinating. Well, I'm a huge Gatsby fan. I know there are people who don't get it, you know.
Yeah.
That's fair. Everything ain't for everybody, but I'm a huge Gatsby fan. And I love to hear you say, Kelly, that you have a multiracial team working on, you know, the reboot, I guess you could say. I have noticed something when I look at graphic novels of The Great Gatsby, because I like graphic novels and comics too. And I've noticed something that is so troubling to me, which is that one of the most interesting scenes in the book doesn't make it into any of the graphic novels I've seen. And I have only seen ones that were created by white artists. Okay. And that is the scene when they're heading across the bridge into Manhattan. It's very early in the book. Tom and they're headed across the bridge to the party. Maybe it's the second or third chapter, and they pass a car full of black people.
Yes.
Not described as black people in the book, but that's who's in the car. And it's like, if there isn't a metaphor for racial anxiety, like European descendants racing across a bridge against a car of black people into sort of the promised land of the city. Like, if that's not rich with racial anxiety, I don't know what it is, but it doesn't make it into, somehow it has not made it into the visual representations of the book that I have seen.
Hmm.
Which to me, you know, I'd be speculating as to why that's the case, right? It could be that the authors fought for it and the editors were like, no, you know, we can only have this many pages or whatever. But yes, I would think that with black people as part of the team that was redoing it or reimagining it, there would be more sensitivity to those aspects of the text.
Yeah. And my black female writer, our black female writer, also writes for John Oliver show. So very, very perceptive individual who's picking up on stuff. So I think that sensibility is something we're looking for. And essentially, while we're talking about culture, and you mentioned, you referred to this earlier, you've got great in a later essay, you say, quote, blackness is the opposite of cultural vacuity. It is ironic that thinking we were inferior, whiteness banished us to the outskirts, only to see us create a culture that is arguably more ripe, rich, and dynamic and borrowed than any other on earth. So it's almost like the appropriation is, well, people have said this, right? Like the flattery of someone copying you. But I mean, it's true. And certainly in our work, we know that innovation comes from being on the edges in many ways and mostly always. And we know that in our work. And yes, I mean, this is like the culture. I mean, it's like Miles Davis, James Baldwin. I mean, just like it's a Mount Rushmore of American innovation.
It is. And that's part of why I say, you know, yes, there's things about being black that are painful. And at times the overall position that we're in this culture feels hopeless. But yeah, I mean, political invention, spiritual invention, you know, the creativity is so massive and so broad. And perhaps it is indeed, you know, what you've said, that sort of there's a particular kind of spark or energy or necessity at the margins that feeds really deep creativity because you're marginalized.
Yeah. Right? Well, our artists have to learn to look at the world differently. And then certain oppressed people have to traffic in the truth of what's going on, or else they're going to get hurt. And that is not the same in the dominant spaces in our culture.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea of you know, you have to be aware of the danger and the darkness. It's basically a matter of survival.
Survival, yeah.
On the outside.
Yeah.
And when you kind of mix that in the pot with the creative impulse, some really magical things can happen. I mean, the only thing about that that I would resist as an idea, even though it's my own idea, is that like it does define blackness or otherness by the very status of otherness, right?
Right.
Derivative. Like it, that's annoying.
Like, yeah, and also doesn't work out great for the artist usually.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I'm always, sometimes I do define blackness against whiteness because it's useful or because it's just the emotional truth of the moment. But I'm always wary of defining anyone who's marginalized by their marginalization because it just doubles the marginalizing, right? It's not.
It just might be they're two different things.
Yeah, that could be it.
I'm always having to explain in like various keynotes that I give the difference between creativity and innovation because people always lump those together because they don't understand them at all.
Are you going to explain them?
Sure. So, first of all, you can have creativity without innovation. You can't have innovation without creativity. Creativity exists in a space where there's no judgment. So we know in our work that you can't improvise well if you're actually judging in the moment and you can't create with other people. So, I'm mostly talking about group creativity. So creativity being that place where you're free to explore and play, there's not rules, or if there are rules, you can change the rules. Innovation then takes that creativity and turns it into a thing or a service or a product or an idea or that, in which there are lots of places of judgment. But they live in different worlds. And so, you know, we do on this podcast a lot of stuff about work because we spend most of our time there. And the big argument that this podcast is making is that we fundamentally are fucking up at work because we're not paying attention to the human condition because it's humans who are at work. And so, if you need people to be creative, give them spaces to be creative without judgment, and then have these other spaces clearly defined so everyone knows what's going on. And so, you know, I've worked at Second City for over 30 years, and the genius of this setup that we've got here is this three-act structure, two acts of scripted content that you come to, a third act that is improvised, where we're making up and playing. That third act is free. It's late at night. You can leave. Other young people can come in. And so we've signaled to the audience that that's our failure lab we're going to play. But then the scripted port, you know, cost money, and you come in, you got to get your tickets ahead of time and all that. So it's like, yeah, let's make this, let's signal, let's design systems, right? It's the system. Right. It's a smart system for that. And the problem in this country and that your book explores is we're not paying attention to the system that got created. And it's not just true of racism, because that's very true. It's also education. We've got a factory system that belies the way that people actually learn. It's crazy that this is going on when, you know, you've worked in the academic sort of like world, right? I mean, it's like,
yeah,
we have all the science that this is, there's a better way, and no one's done anything about it. It's nuts.
Well, we're path dependent, right? We have a way of, especially as groups, of being stuck on the path that we're already on, you know? So, like, talk about creativity and innovation. We are often path dependent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I have so many notes, and we're actually running out of time. I think that the other area I want to explore, because I hadn't thought about any of this in this way, because I used to watch Law and Order SVU as well.
You, me, and everybody else.
And everybody else. But that's really problematic, like in many, many ways. I'm going to read this just because I think it's such beautiful writing. You say, quote, "I saw no patterns at all, nor for years did I see how my love of SVU exemplified a broader theme in the culture, our collective willingness to gulp down violence against women as entertainment, and how that norm helps to shove women like me, who would prefer to rage against such violence, into a chronic, numbed bardo of normalization and consumption." Last sentence is killer. Very good use of the word bardo.
Thank you. Yes.
I read that out loud to my wife. She goes, "Very good use of the word bardo." I was like, yeah, that's good.
Thank you. I actually remember when I was struggling to find that word, like, with that sentence, just like, what is the exact space that I am trying to conjure? And then somehow bardo popped into my head. Yeah, maybe I should think George Saunders, because it probably
exactly
probably introduced it to me. Yeah, SVU, problematic. I mean, I feel I should say I am not dragging SVU. It's complicated. There is something to be said for stories being told. I do not want to get hate mail from SVU fans.
No, it's just, it's what we started the conversation with. You can actually appreciate those really good actors who are cool and we kind of all are hot for. Let's be honest, all of them. Some pretty, like, really good, like, I love noir, right? If you have an interest in that world, it's a contemporary noir of sorts.
Yeah, and, you know, the cadence is just almost soothing. It's so familiar. You can have it on in the background and you just feel like someone's reading you a bedtime story because you can follow the cadence almost by who's on the screen, right? There's something about it that's really soothing. So not dragging it at all. And in fact, I still watch it. I just don't watch the episodes where the women are being mutilated, raped, tortured, you know, whatever, where misogyny is the life force of the storytelling or the plot. And I would say it took me, I don't know, 20 years of watching the show to have the realization that something was amiss with my identity as a feminist and my identity as someone who has been sexually assaulted and my identity as someone who absolutely hates and rages against violence against women and how, you know, endemic it is in our culture, but at the same time could sit on the couch for hours and hours. I mean, you watch one of those marathons, right? You could pass the whole weekend watching visceral depictions of women being tortured and violated and all of that. And it was the tension within me that caused me to think about, you know, why am I doing this? And what is the role of this program in the culture? And the role of the program obviously is very complicated. As I said, like, storytelling is important and it's important to tell these stories because they do reflect reality to some extent. On the other hand, like, they also profoundly normalize it. Like, when you take this topic and wrap it in the kind of sweet frosting of entertainment, and you build it to be something that is bingeable, you know, like, the benefit of the storytelling is not free. Like, you are normalizing this and you are teaching people how the culture works. Like, you're teaching men how the culture works. You're teaching women how the culture works. That's a binary way of thinking about it, but, you know, as a shorthand. And, you know, what people are being taught is, like, that women get violated, and that there's sort of something normal and repetitive about it. And, I don't know that that is wholly benign. Hence my interrogation of the show and my own desire to watch it.
Yeah. I was trying to think of the archetype, which was, I think, Damsel in Distress, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like, it's basically a Disney movie, but darker.
But I think in a modern media landscape, when there are things like binging, you start to then see under the undergirding of what that might, it might become problematic, because it's like everything these days. It's like, you could have, like, difficult conversations that end up being, like, really nuanced and interesting, or you can just drag someone on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's just like, there's got to be space for us to disagree or misunderstand or make a mistake and recover from it.
Totally.
Because we all, I mean, this book is littered with it. We all do that. We all make, like, I thank God I didn't grow up. You must do this too, in terms of, like, young people today, what they have to deal with in terms of, like, what they said 5 minutes ago.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus. Oh, God. I can't even imagine. I was recalling, so I grew up in a very wealthy suburb of Chicago called Kenilworth. I know I did this. I'm admitting this on the air right now. Had a Malcolm X hat, had the black hat with the X. And, like, I would punch myself in the face if I, like, could encounter myself now, then.
Well, hopefully you'd punch yourself in the face and then you'd put your arm around yourself and say, let me familiarize you with the historical record, my friend, that you can buy a better fucking hat.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes. I can. That's the point, right? Be able to like take the hard hit, but then
You call someone out, but you call them back in. Like you don't leave them out there, right?
Yeah. But because again, like we can't know another's mind nor their intentions. And that's just true. And people are complicated. And like that's always the thing with microaggressions, which is like there are so many different ways that I could feel a disrespect towards you. Like the list is really, really long for any of us to pick the one. It's like, oh, that's why you're behaving. Or it's the I had a shitty day, you know, kind of thing. And I'm just like being a dick or whatever because I had that shitty day. So it's complicated. And again, the thing I loved about this book, and I'm going to make you tell a yes and story in a moment. Okay. But the thing I did love about this book is that it's not afraid of its complications. And you're not afraid to sort of look at your own complications, but how they fit inside a complicated system. And then you take the reader through the many journeys of that to the one that comes profoundly at the end that you don't go on about, which I'm kind of glad because it's one of those things of like, you just left it there. Was that your white husband didn't vote in the election that got Trump elected?
This is true.
You just fucking leave that there and then kind of move on and don't reference it again. I'm like, oh man.
Man. Well, I wanted to stay married. So doing a deep dive into that in the public forum, you know, but yeah, I will, you know, I'll just leave it at that. What I said in the book.
Yeah, no, lovely. All right. So the way we always end the podcast with our guest is we ask for a yes and story in the parlance of improvisation. When two people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They don't get very far by saying yes. They say yes and. They affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
The thing I'm thinking of that like is this sort of inflection point or a moment, I guess, at which I said yes to something that I, for my entire life, had said no to vigorously, vehemently, was willingly accepting and almost like, I wouldn't say seeking out, but like whatever is just shy of seeking out, the process of gaining weight through no longer dieting. Oh. So moving from the sort of status quo of my life for so many years, which was like profound restriction and control around food, into a freer space that I knew was going to cause me to gain weight. And, you know, but also like restore my mental and emotional health, if nothing else, and free up my creativity. You know, but it was going to come with this sort of like consequence probably of gaining weight. And I did gain weight and have gained weight. And, life goes on, as it turns out. There, like, it was not the end of the world to, just simply become fat and sort of come out as a fat person. I have a strong feeling that this is not actually what you were looking for. And
no, it's 1,000% what I'm looking for.
Is it really?
It's funny. This weekend we took like a weekend vacation up in Michigan with family. And, one of the people had been sent to a fat camp when they were younger. And we're talking about these experiences, but decided to embrace the weirdness and all of that with just sort of joy and gratitude and love. And they're just like, okay with who they are. And it was, I found it a really sort of refreshing because I know the biases that exist in this country in particular at this time around that. And, you know, I've fluctuated in weight before and, you know, it's just not healthy. So I think the idea of examining what means healthy to you, which is your soul and your mind and your body, and that's the thing you're trying to link up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the dieting that's just going to be crushing is not going to speak to all of who you are. And if this book is anything, it's sort of like, here's who I am. Here's who I am. It's a lot of different stuff. It makes life complicated for me and probably for others, but I'm here and I'm writing about it and maybe there's a happy ending in there.
I think there is a happy ending. And I think, you know, there's a way that like I don't know, counterculture is just better than like the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Like if you can embrace the aspects of yourself that are counterculture, like there's so much freedom and fun and joy there. And, you know, it's in some ways a more interesting and vibrant place to be than to be smack dab in the middle of the normativity, even though the culture often has this kind of scrambling to get to smack dab middle normativity. But yeah, there's this way more happening on the outskirts, I have found.
The book is called Don't Let It Get You Down, Essays on Race, Gender, and the Body. Savala Nolan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly. This was a lot of fun.
Getting the Yes And is produced by The Second City, Second City Works, and WGN Radio. It's also produced by Elif Garris, with help by Mike Farinacchio and Colleen Fahey. The music that you hear that intros and outros the program is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you want to get more information on The Second City, you can reach us at www.secondcityworks.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.